You're listening to Two Guys Talking Wine with Michael Pincus and Andre Prue.
Hello, Michael.
Andre. That's it. That's all I got.
That's all
for you.
You got?
That's all I got for you today.
So we're joined by a special guest, but before we get into this, I want to frame it a little bit. You catalog people's wine cellars.
Yes.
And occasionally, obviously with the permission of whose cellars you catalog, something follows you home.
Sometimes, yes. Yeah.
And you were a mensch. I believe that's what your people say. And
that's a good terminology, yeah.
Yeah, and you brought me a bottle of one of my favorites that I obviously don't have the patience to cellar, and B, just haven't had the finances to do. And it's this bottle of 2009 Montebello.
Yep.
And you're setting the bar for us pretty high for me and Anya in our household. Anya's my wife. Because this wine was incredibly memorable.
Okay.
I'm going to remember what this wine tastes like. So you and I, we did some talking. We were just like, you know what? Let's reach out to the people at Ridge Vineyards and see if someone will interview us. And I guess we set...
Or talk to us. No, we'll interview them.
Yeah.
They don't have to interview us.
Sorry, I guess maybe I'm just getting a little starstruck.
Andre's very excited by this whole deal. Because we do have somebody from Ridge. And let's have him introduce himself. First, and give us some background, and then we will quiz him, I guess, or Andre will geek out, and I will try and bring him back in.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for having me, guys. I'm John Olney. I'm the head winemaker at Ridge Vineyards. I've been with Ridge now for almost 25 years.
Wow.
Before I joined Ridge, I got into the wine business and the import business, working for an importer in California, Kermit Lynch. So I sort of cut my teeth on a lot of European wines. And when I got to California, started looking for a job in the wine business, I found that Ridge wines were a little more appealing to me, maybe a little bit more of a restrained style, not really going necessarily for the bigger is better kind of, bold move. And drew me there, and I met Paul Draper in the 90s, and he offered me a job, and here I am today.
All right, so that's 25 years. That's a
that's
long,
a long
that's
time.
That's a long time to be in one winery, right? So
we have a long tenure at Ridge.
So he would have made this 2009.
Yeah, you would have made this 2009. Wait, how long have you been the head winemaker?
Yeah, that's
for
a good
Ridge?
Point. Sorry.
Yeah, I've only been head winemaker for about 2.5 years.
So Okay. You were there for the 2009.
Yeah,
is basically what you're saying. So what were you doing in 2009? I should ask that.
Well, in 2009, I was in charge. Of the Lytton Springs winery. So my focus was more on the Zinfandels that time, where you were, Andre. We all participate. Montebello is certainly the most, it's the one that we put the most effort into in terms of blending, in terms of assembling the wine, and it's really a whole wine team effort.
I've had many a Lytton Springs wine, so I like those wines.
I like those wines. I also am a big fan of the facility, and I'm sure we'll get into, because I mean, one of the things that drew me to the brand in the first place was I'm a sucker for a good label. I think everyone who's listened to this podcast is probably sick of me talking about how much I love a label, and it's just the iconic Ridge labels. The first time I went to California was in 2015. I'm so old I can't remember when, but I drove down there. I drove down there and visited Lytton Springs, was working on a radio salary, didn't have a lot of money in my pocket, and was warmly received by your staff. But it's something when you set your foot in the tasting room at Lytton Springs, you can see that it's like the Montebello is an icon wine. It is not a wine that everyone can afford. It's not a wine that everyone can open on a Friday night. But the experience that you get visiting Ridge is it's very much like, mothers and daughters going and tasting wines for their weddings that they can afford, and like, dude bros just out checking out what's happening in Sonoma County. And it's just like,
are you gonna ask John a question here?
Yeah, I guess the question I'm just going is, it's just
like we're here
to talk about Montebello, but it's just like, how important is it when you work for a brand like Ridge to, you talked about putting a lot of effort into the Montebello, but for the Three Valleys, which I think at the time I visited the winery was about $20. I think it's now about $30, which is still very good value. How important is it to put effort into that entry level so that someone new to wine gets access to your brand?
It's super important. I mean, that's one of the things I really kind of admire about Ridge is that, you know, Ridge started with Montebello. So they literally found sort of an abandoned Cabernet vineyard in the 50s. And the original founders of Ridge started looking around California for more Cabernet. And believe it or not, at that time, Napa was almost all Zinfandel and Petite Syrah. So they're finding these old vines vineyards of Zinfandel, and rather than try to force that into making it a Cabernet, they just respected what it was. It was from a warmer climate, and they kept making it. In other words, we don't just make Cabernet. We have we take Zinfandel seriously as well. And it does allow that, starting with the Three Valleys, it gives people a way to, introduce themselves without a huge, investment, and then, work their way up from there as they choose.
So I'm a big Zinfandel fan. So I really appreciate that you guys actually do treat it with respect, because there is so much Zinfandel out there that is just that gobby, sweet. And I do remember once telling somebody I was drinking Zinfandel and they started laughing, and I had to tell them that it was like red Zinfandel, not that pink stuff, right? Because everybody, even to this day, it's amazing when you say I like Zinfandel, people just start laughing because it's all they remember is that pink goo. So
yeah,
is there a question in there, Michael?
Well, there is. You never made pink goo with Zinfandel, did you, John?
Full disclosure, uh-oh, I think that I think Ridge made at least one, maybe two vintages of rosé Zinfandel or white Zinfandel, I should say.
Yeah,
but short-lived.
Thank God, because I much prefer when people take it, absolutely seriously, because it is a great wine, and I love barbecue. That's the reason I love Zinfandel, and so. I know Andre wants to get into these Montebellos. We talked about Lytton Springs. I know you guys make the Three Valleys. I know you make a single vineyard or a single Cabernet Sauvignon. Here in Ontario, I don't think we see a lot of Ridge wines.
No, we see like the core. I mean, it's the other
thing. We see the core,
yeah,
but
it's the other thing too, where it's just like I can't preach enough how important it is to go visit this winery, because you walk into the tasting room and there is always a ton of stuff on the shelf. Like the two times I've been there, it's stuff where it's just like, this wasn't on your website.
So that's what I wanted to ask John. John, what are the wines that, not just the core wines that we see here, but what else do you guys do at Ridge?
Right. So, good question. We have a really robust direct consumer program. So, and what that allows us is to go out and we find, a great example. Sonoma County will find a small producer, 100-year-old vines, mixed field blend, we call it Zinfandel Vineyard. But it's only 5 tons, right? So you're going to make 200-300 cases, and it just that doesn't really work in terms of distributing that all over the country and into Canada. So those ones, we can sell right out of the tasting room, and it creates something exciting for people to come to the winery and be able to trace something that they can't find on the shelf.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is quite interesting.
So Montebello, Lytton Springs, they're basically the core wines. What are the other core wines of Ridge?
The Geyserville,
yep.
In terms of Zinfandel, okay. Definitely. And then the, so to speak, sister wine to the Montebello is our Estate Cabernet. So it's also from the Montebello Vineyard. It tends to be the parcels that are a little, I wouldn't say, they're just a, we think that they mature just a little sooner. Sort of drink that while you're waiting for your Montebello.
That's the one I try to keep in the house as someone who's impatient. And it is the unfortunate thing. When you go to the States, you can usually find that for like $50-$60 US. In Canada, it's now north of 110 after taxes and everything. But even at 110, like, I hate how like snobby that makes us sound, but it's still an affordable luxury to buy one bottle or two bottles a year to tide you over till your Montebellos are ready.
So a few years ago, I remember going down to Florida, and I went to a place called the Tasting Room, which is one of these places that has those, you know, tasting machines that you, you know, put a few dollars in, and they give you a little. And I don't know what was wrong with the wine. It didn't taste like it was wrong, so that's the good news. They had Lytton Springs on for $20.
Oh, geez.
And I bought like three or four of them. So I was, that's, you know, I knew that I was getting a good wine. I don't know why they had it for $20. Is that, that's not normal, is it there, John?
It was like a tasting or
oh, no, there was a whole bottle. Yeah, that's why I bought a bunch of them. But it was.
Yeah, that's not normal at all. I'm not sure
maybe they didn't know what they had, fell off the back of a truck. I'm not really sure. Maybe. But I was, because I saw that on their website and I was like, we got to go there. Because they have no idea what they've got.
All right, so let's bring it back to talking about the two wines, the reason why we reached out to John and you were kind enough to join us. So when we tasted that 09 Montebello, supremely memorable, but I think the important thing for someone like me, it was still youthful and vibrant. I don't like old wine. I'm unashamed in saying I don't like when my wine tastes like a baseball glove. I don't like it when my wine is all dried up. I still like it when the fruit is vibrant and fresh. When we opened this bottle, the tannin was silky soft, like it rolled off the back of the tongue, and it just had this intensity. This particular one is 72% Cab Sauv, 22% Merlot, 6% Petit Verdot. What can you tell us about 09 as a growing year? And I guess we'll do follow-up questions after that instead of me asking three at once like I usually do. Yeah, let's do that.
Well, a couple things. I mean, 09 was really, it's kind of one of those kind of magical years. I sometimes call them get out of the way years where the grapes were in perfect balance. We had great acidity. There was some good ripeness to it, but still, again, in that kind of a more restrained style. So we had really, really elegant tannins. So it was a really tight-knit wine when it was young. You know, and to your point, Andre, that, you know, I totally agree. I think that, you know, I think that there's sometimes it's easy to get caught up in sort of the idea that, you know, the older the wine, the better it is. And that isn't really all the case. And often, like you say, once the fruit starts to wane, it starts getting a little, you know, there's it's missing an element. Right. And it really maybe it isn't even as interesting as it was when it was young. Hmm. The beauty of Montebello to me is that, you know, it's a wine of considerable tannin and structure, and when it's young, it's really an example, I think, of a wine which actually really does get better with age. And what I find that's really exciting about it, and to your point about the 09, is that it's usually around 10 years where the fruit starts to actually emerge as the tannins start to soften. Which is a little, you know, a little bit of the opposite of what most wines do.
So I guess the follow-up question I was going to throw into that one then is with something like the 2019 that we're going to talk about shortly, or I guess with anyone who has some Montebello in their cellar right now, what is the drinking window typically? And I know it differs from vintage to vintage, so I'm not going to hit you with like a blank at all. So let's talk like generally. But what is the general drinking window for something like a Montebello where tannin soften, fruit comes out, we're not getting into dried out fruit?
I think, you know, I would say up to 25 years in any vintage.
Holy crap.
What was it? What, I'm trying to remember. Oh, we had our English importer was actually visiting us a week and a half ago, and I was having lunch and Paul Draper came down and we opened up a Magnum of 1972 and it was pristine. I mean, it was fresh, really an amazing wine. So, yeah, it's you just don't see that often, you know, and that's really one of the remarkable things about that wine.
You know, it's actually funny that you talk about like the maintaining the freshness. It was strange because I said I don't like old wines, but the night that we opened up the 09, Michael actually brought an Australian wine that was a quarter century old.
Correct, 25 years old. It was from Yolamba. It was their Octavius Shiraz, which is from their oldest vineyards, and it Andre was like, this is not going to be good. And it was just an absolute pristine condition. It was just amazing.
But to your point, though, like, that doesn't happen often. Like, those are very, very rare wines, like, to the point where,
it really is. I mean, in my experience, you know, we're talking about the 1 and 1.5% of all, really, of all the wines that are made. You know, it's pretty rare, yeah.
Correct, and that people would hold it for 25 years is another...
Right.
So no, you know, they say about, you know, wine collecting, the longer obviously you hold it, the more rare that wine gets, obviously, yeah. because there's now less and less and less bottles of it.
Yeah.
But there are very few people in this world who are holding things, you know, 25 years.
Well, I guess speaking of 25 years or lack of 25 years, let's slide into the 2019.
Well, the first question that I think Andre had about the 2019, and I think I answered it, but, you know, I might as well go right to the source. Your capsule is like half the length. I have an idea of why it is, but I might as well have, you know, the expert tell me why it is, unless you want me to tell you what I think, and then you can tell me I'm wrong or right.
No, go for it.
Yeah, let's hear it, Michael.
So it's... it's so you can see the branded cork. You can see the year. It is a counterfeit issue, if I'm not mistaken.
I guess half and half. In other words, it is we do it so that you can see the can see the brand.
Correct.
You know,
yeah.
and sort of look at it and like, oh, it's rich. It's not a counterfeit measure. You know, we take other measures for that, but it's you know, because that's, you know, it's, you can actually, you know, you can take the capsule off and you can see if it says ridge or not. So,
yeah, so that's right. But I'm, my understanding was that some of these were counterfeit measures. So you can see the year that, you know, anybody can change.
He answered that. He answered that.
I got it. But so, but it still didn't answer why it's a half capsule.
I guess that's true.
So the consumer can see the ridge. It's just being able to see the.
So it wasn't a counterfeit measure. It was just as it was a stylistic thing.
Stylistic. There we go.
Oh, okay, got it. All right,
gotcha. And okay, so let's move into growing year. I mean, it's kind of funny when you talked about the drinking window, answering the drinking window question. Is it really does? For those listening to this podcast right now, the 2019 describes exactly as John would, like the tannin. Is crazy high. The acids are crazy high, like to the point where it's surprising. So 13.7% alcohol, but it's just like, you know, I just wanted to ask because I know this is going to morph into that wine, like you said, in I'm gonna guess in 10 to 25 years, maybe even a bit longer with how the acids attack. The question I have is can you just tell us a little bit about 2019 as a growing year?
Yeah, so 2019 was you know, we'd had several years. We had some drought, we had some short years, and then 2019 was sort of a rebound year where we actually had really, you know, really good yields, you know, not crazy, but, you know, the wines were, they were, you know, like you said, there's plenty of tannin there, but they are actually a little bit more, forward in the sense of there actually was a little bit more fruit going on there. So, you know, a lot of people enjoy drinking it right out of barrel more than we usually would. I don't think that, you know, for me, that doesn't, it kind of reminds me a lot. You know, Paul Draper used to talk about the 1991 and said that it was one of the vintages that it wasn't the biggest vintage, but it was super balanced. And a lot of people thought because it was tasting good when it was young that it would never age. But then, you know, we keep pulling it out every 10 years and it's still a beautiful wine. So I think that's a similar thing for the 19. I think that, you know, just because it's a little more, approachable, I think it's got all the time in the world ahead of it.
So I do find this wine very approachable, first of all. But you know what? One of the things we didn't mention, and we should have right off the hop, and you kind of bring us to that talking about the weather. Hey, how is the weather in California these days? let's say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like, you know, anywhere you go, when I'm talking to winemakers from everywhere, and California's no exception. Look, it's getting warmer. Yeah,
Today, which is where you're in the 30s.
Except for today, right?
So when we're recording this, California is unseasonably cold.
seasonally cold.
And you told us it was 30, and we're in, Hamilton. We're in the Hamilton studio, and we're actually warmer here in Ontario than they are in California at the moment, so that's pretty interesting. But you also got a really deluge of rain this year, to the point where things were underwater, correct?
Which we were really looking forward to, and it was accompanied by records amount of snow, which is even better because, you know, the snow melt is where we get most of our water in California. And the biggest thing I think that most people I think find is to your point about, you know, the fact that it's warmer in Ontario than California right now is it's more unpredictable. You know, that used to be that you could, you know, you knew what your temperature ranges were going to be going into harvest, and now you're not quite sure what to expect. And that's, you know, that makes things, you know, you have to be able to react a lot quicker, you know, because often we're getting these it seems like either we get a big heat wave, right, because the grapes are getting ripe, or it just cools down forever. And so you need to be able to, you know, everything we do is hand-picked, so we have to have, you know, a standing army ready to get in there and get the grapes off the vine. If your aim is to make a balanced wine that isn't, you know, 15.5% alcohol.
And when you have your fires out there, are they really close to your vineyards, or, you know, usually you're pretty protected somehow?
We had some that were really close up in Sonoma, in 2020. And the big problem, you know, we had fires, I mean, gosh, just about every year from 17 to 20. In most years, the fires come at the very, very end of the season, because the winds shift and they start blowing from the desert towards the west, and they bring in this hot air, and that's what fans the fires. What happened in 2020 was we had fires that were started by lightning, and they started in late August, so the grapes were still on the vine. Usually the grapes are off the vine, and the smoke is, you know, it's unfortunate and you know, makes it not very fun to breathe, but the grapes are in the winery and everything's good. You know, the issue with 2020, if you were really close to the fire, is, you know, the grapes can absorb some of the smoke. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were vineyards that, you know, a lot of people didn't pick. There were some that we didn't pick.
Interesting. I mean, that's something we deal with a lot in Canada, up in the Okanagan, where we hear about the smoke taint. And I know that's something the winemakers there are really, really preoccupied with trying to mitigate. I guess one thing I'd like taking a look at the back and forth, like, you know, you said it's important to be able to react quickly at a standing army ready to get into the vineyards to do the hand pick. What would you say the biggest change has taken place at Ridge Vineyards between, I don't know, let's just say over the past 10 years, like between 2009 and 2019 in the vineyard to help be prepared to deal with the unpredictability of the climate?
Well, you know, definitely staffing up, because, you know, that has become a more difficult, you know, it's harder and harder to, you know, to get, you know, to find people, you know, to pick. You know, I think the other things are that, you know, we've really, we've made a lot of improvements also to our winery, so that we have a lot more, you know, we almost have like an excess of tanks, so that when we do bring everything in, I mean, we can bring in, 25% of the harvest in a week, you know, so they're really that being able to, sort of absorb a lot of grapes at once is become really important.
And how long is the harvest? Because I just got back from Italy, and it's interesting to, you know, we here in Ontario have the longest grape harvest in the world because we have to include ice wine in it, so it can be up to 6 months. In Italy, because they, you know, really compress how many grapes you can actually have, they actually regulate it. Sometimes you're talking to a winery and they go, yeah, we start at the beginning of September and we're done, you know, by the middle or the end. So, you know, 30 days. Where does California sit as far as, you know, that length of harvest?
It depends a little bit on the makeup of the grapes that you're growing. For example, if all that we grew was Zinfandel, then it would probably be 5 to 6 weeks. right? Because it's, you know, because it's all, it's one variety subject to more or less the same climate. But the fact that we also make Cabernet at Montebello, that really extends it, because Cabernet and also at Montebello, because we have the proximity to the Pacific Ocean. So it's almost like this air conditioner over the vineyard. That changes everything. So, I mean, that extends, you know, we'll pick, we'll start picking Montebello at least 2 to 3 weeks after we've already started Zinfandel. So that extends it out over, you know, a full 2 months.
Now, you've talked about your own background and your connection to old world wines. And I guess your formal education is informed by the old world. I'm guessing largely beyond 25 years of on-the-job experience in California. Do you find that the winemaking at Ridge is more informed by old-world style of winemaking versus, I guess, what consumers might come to expect from California? Or is it something that's been sort of a moving target as consumer tastes have changed over the years?
Definitely the former. You know, Paul Draper, you know, he spent a lot of time in Europe. That's where he learned about wine, especially in Bordeaux. You know, it's Paul sometimes likes to say that, you know, we've never hired a winemaker with an enology degree. And you know, I think, you know, and I have lots of friends who have enology degrees. They're wonderful winemakers. You know, but I think maybe the point being a little bit that there it's a little bit of the nature versus nurture sort of thing, in the sense that I sometimes call the winemaking at Ridge sort of faith-based winemaking, in the sense that, you know, we're going to let we trust that the process, we've been making, you know, Ridge is, we're in our 60th anniversary. Okay. We've been making wine from Montebello from the same vineyard. So we have faith that, you know, we don't have to add yeast. The process is going to work. And we don't need to add malolactic starter enzymes, so on and so forth, because, you know, we think we have the right raw materials, and we've seen it work. You know, we have that experience, which I think is really, you know, crucial.
I don't even know what to say to that. It's just like really cool to, I mean, because it's like, you know, you see. Like the movement and the movement towards natural wine, and I put that in air quotes, like, and it's almost like dogmatic that consumers are heading a certain way where winemakers are like natural wine, where they're like too cool for school. And you talk to a producer like Ridge, you talk to a producer like LaPierre, and it's just like in Beaujolais, you know, yeah. I know we're dealing with like broadly different comparisons, but it's just like you're dealing with a heritage of being a little bit hands off while still managing to, I'm guessing you're, I think you actually list sulfur as an ingredient on the bottle, which is something I appreciate as a point of transparency, but it's just like, so what you're doing as opposed to some of these people making dirty hippie juice is what? Just putting an addition at the end, so you're making a shelf stable product?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I interned at Marcel LaPierre's.
of course you did.
I totally respect what they do. In fact, I love a lot of their wines. You know, look, we're not making 00 wine. You know, in other words, we respect the process, but yes, we use sulfur dioxide. You know, we're monitoring it for Brettanomyces. If we see Brettanomyces, we'll step in. You know, but you know, and we do a light filtration before bottling. So I'm not saying that, you know, we're completely non-interventionist, but I think that if you take the other side of that coin, then, I think you see it in a lot of places, you know, you have just total control where you're, the winemaker is controlling every single, there has to be an addition of this.
But you said something that was very important in what you just said there. You said when necessary, right?
Yes.
When you talked about Brett arriving, you said intervention when necessary. And like, that's, I think, the difference between a high quality producer. And this isn't just me like kissing your guys' butt, because clearly I'm a fanboy. But like, when you're dealing with people who are doing dogmatic winemaking who are following the recipe for the sake of following the recipe. Often it's a marketing decision, and the quality of the product be damned, I can go to the market and say that I've made a wine that I've done nothing to. And it's just like, it's, I don't know, I still don't completely get it. And it's just like, when I hear you talk about your process and the history there about being as hands-off as possible, I think that is something that's more aspirational. And frankly, when you take a look at the end product, having something that's relatively consistent regardless of vintage conditions is something that I think should be more aspirational than, so this is just me editorializing right now, but I mean, if you want to
yet again, I think you just put it really eloquently.
Okay, I appreciate that.
So I want to go back to the We Found a Vineyard. It sounds like the start of a book. We found a vineyard.
Once upon a time.
Yeah, once upon a time, we stumbled onto this vineyard. First of all, do you know how old that cab vineyard was?
So here's the quick history. It actually goes back much farther than that. In the 1880s, Osseo Peroni, who was an Italian immigrant, a physician from San Francisco, he bought a piece of property, which today is Montebello up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is pretty amazing when you, if you drive up there, to think that he was, you know, this is before any kind of, mechanical mechanisms. They planted grapes up there, and they actually made the original winery, which is still, you know, our winery today. And one of the unique things about Montebello is this one of the rare places in California where there's limestone, and limestone is perfect for digging out, you know, caves that are naturally supporting. So it's actually one of the only true wine caves in California. So wine was being made there in the 1880s. And then you get to the 20s and everything fell apart because of Prohibition. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, when it became abandoned. And then a man named William Short planted vines, I believe, after Prohibition. I'd have to check. Like, I could be wrong on the dates, but I'm going to say late 30s into the 40s. So then that was sort of the remnants of his vineyard that were found in the late 50s.
So you're talking about a vineyard that's probably 15 years old at the time.
So then
you're dealing with some material, and I'm assuming you've replanted some of this stuff, but do you have 75-year-old vines still kicking around there?
I think there's a few of them on the knoll, but they're more, you know, they're just sort of symbolic ones left over. It's Cabernet is not an easy grape to the wine from it ages well, but the vines don't age so well. They get Eutypa, which is a wood disease. That comes in, you know, usually when you're pruning. So, you know, anything over 50 years old is kind of rare for a Cabernet.
Interesting.
That is interesting. Well, because I mean, if you visit the Lytton Springs site, as I have, you can walk through the vineyard and you see some gnarly old as like old AF Zinfandel vines that are still producing a decent yield, if I'm not mistaken.
But none of them are Cab, obviously. So the Zinfandel you have is in the 100? Category?
Oh, right. I mean, some of it's 120 years old. Okay. Yeah.
So I know that, you know, if you walk through Australia, you can get some of the Shiraz that's, you know, they call tri-century vines, which are the, not 300 years, but they've been through the 18s, the 19s, and then into the 2000s.
I got you. So John, you mentioned the word limestone, which is a perfect segue for me to talk about another one of the great wines that I don't know if Ridge is as well known for, but I mean, I am Captain Chardonnay after all. How does the limestone impact the growth of the Chardonnay? And I think your Chardonnay is on the Montebello site, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. Yeah, that's why we've not only limited Chardonnay to planting at Montebello, but we've always, you know, the original founders were, you know, they when they discovered, you know, limestone, they started planting the Chardonnay really in the places where there was, you know, where you had sort of limestone outcroppings, you know, sort of like they do in Burgundy and the Côte d'Aubon. And that's what we still do today. You know, if we see a site where there's a higher amount of limestone, well, that's kind of where we target to plant Chardonnay.
Interesting.
So how many acres of vine does Ridge have under its umbrella?
Under the whole umbrella? Well, in Sonoma County, we own or lease about 300 acres of vines. And, you know, Montebello is a little trickier because it's all terraced. It's all, you know, so, you plant 90 acres and you get about, 65 in terms of what's planted.
Mm.
Interesting. All very interesting. Andre, do you have any more
questions? No, I actually really, really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with us about the wines. I actually did, I know we talked about cost, but I did manage with a group of friends. I have a group of friends where we pool our money to buy choice bottles, and I think they're going to be very disappointed when I go back to them and tell them we can't open our 2019 Montebello that I bought for another decade. Because we were hoping to.
I think this wine is very approachable now. I would agree with John that this one's probably.
I think it's lacking the depth. Like the 09 was epic. Like the moment that hit your mouth, it was one of those ratatouille wines. Like the moment when Anton Ego puts the ratatouille in his mouth, and you're just like this is what this is supposed to taste like. The 2019 is not there for me yet, and I would rather I'd rather strap in and wait the 10 years.
I don't think you do it. I know you. You don't do it. So I'm gonna answer.
He's probably right.
John's question, though, because although we are not a video podcast, John did make mention that Andre is wearing a Toronto Maple Leaf shirt.
I am. It's a jersey. And, I love it a lot.
And I will tell John that he did get a bowl of soup with that. So, yeah. So
I don't get the reference.
It's a soup kitchen thing. You get something to wear and you get a bowl of soup. So yeah. That's the only reason I can assume that somebody would wear a Maple Leafs jersey. And John is a St. Louis fan and I as a Montreal fan cannot understand why you would wear Maple Leafs jersey.
Here's where we can do the sign-offs. John, are you on social media? Is there a way people can follow your exploits through the vineyard, or is it just the winery they should follow? How can we connect with you?
Yeah, it's the winery you should follow. Yeah, we've got a very robust social media site going on.
That was a lot of fun.
You also have a bottle of Montelier water here, so you went with the whole Monte.
Well, it's just like it's the word for mountain, so Montelier, so Mount Elie, Montebello, beautiful mountain.
Correct. So you went with the whole mountain theme on today's podcast. So I'm very proud of you.
I am excited that I actually have a bottle of this Montebello in my cellar.
And just to say that, you know, the Leafs have a mountain to climb because when they get to the playoffs, they forget
Andre
how Prue. To play.
You can follow me on social media at Andre Wine Review.
I'm Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com.
Support us on Patreon. Check the show notes. I'm actually using them now, so you'll be able to find Ridge Vineyard's social media and their website. I know I talked about it a bit during the podcast, but if you visit the winery, I cannot, and they have not paid us to say this, cannot say enough how worth it is to go to Lytton Springs. Michael, we should go there sometime.
I'd love to go. I've never been to that part of California. I'm a big fan of Ridge Wines. I really am.
Road trip!
So we're gonna get in the car. We're gonna get in the car today, and we'll be in California in a few days, and we'll probably get
We'll escape the balmy weather in Hamilton and go to the cold. Anyways,
yeah,
snow. You got to sign off still.
Oh, yeah, I'm Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com. I think I've already said that. Social media is the grape guy, and also is Michael Pincus. Andre, it's been a pleasure sitting beside you drinking Ridge. Let's go finish the bottle. Good night.
Road trip!
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Two Guys Talking Wine on iTunes.
Two Guys Talking Wine is produced by Jim Ray, Adam Duran, and Ken Little.